Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm joined again on the podcast today by bestselling writer Dean Koontz. Dean's latest novel, After Death, will be published on July 18th. Koontz hardly needs an introduction. His books are published in 38 languages, and he has sold over 500 million copies to date. Dean, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me back there again. I guess I behaved myself the last time.
You did. You did. Well, thanks for joining us. I wanted to ask you, if someone hasn't yet heard about your new novel, After Death, how would you describe the novel?
Well, it involves a man who is part of an experiment. He was head of security, a very highly secured laboratory. And something went wrong in an experiment they were doing, and 55 people everywhere in the building ended up dead. He is the only one who comes back to life. And he comes back to life with an ability that's quite extraordinary. He comes back to life not just with the ability, but with a mission. And the book unfolds from that moment in.
Can you pinpoint the original idea or impetus that led you to writing After Death?
Sometimes you know exactly where an idea started or came from. In this case, I can't pin it down, except that I've been reading a lot about the singularity, that moment with technology and biology combined in the human species is supposedly lifted up into a higher plane by all of this. And I've always thought it won't work out that way. It won't necessarily be a disaster. That's not what this book is about. But whatever happens will be something unanticipated. And that was sort of the thing in the back of my head for quite a while. And I guess at some point it matured into this idea. But I can't pinpoint the moment when it happened. I actually was working on another book. And when this one came into my head, with that little opening scene, which actually isn't the opening scene, slightly later. When that came into my head, I put the other book aside and went on to this one, did it first. That's about as much as I can tell you. Ideas a lot of times are mysterious where they come from or why they come down to your writing.
Does that happen to you often, where you'll have an idea in the middle of a book and then switch?
No, it's extremely rare. Usually, when I'm in the middle of a book, my focus, sorry for my voice this morning, I've got a touch of laryngitis, but generally, when I'm in the middle of a book, everything is about getting it finished. And I don't want any distraction from that. And so it's very unusual. In this case, I think it was a combination of two things. One, I found this idea very intriguing. And two, the novel at this partway through, I had reached a point where I was uncertain what was going to happen at the end of that book. And I need to have a little better idea. I don't plan out plots, but if I get halfway through and I'm mystified, then I've got something I have to brood upon. And in this case, it took enough brooding I could write an entire book.
In terms of talking about outlines, I think that you said after Strangers that you threw away detailed outlines and you kind of dive into the book and the narrative and the characters. I wondered if we could talk just a moment about that actual idea of creation. When you do sit down on day one of a new book, and obviously this wouldn't be the case because you had this idea for the scene, but when you do sit down on day one of a new book, do you usually have a rough idea in your head, or do you literally sit down to a blank page?
I pretty much sit down to a blank page, except I know what the opening scene or two is going about. And in the case of After Death, I knew that this character was going to show up. He's walking through nighttime Beverly Hills, very late at night, but after midnight. And that's a town where anyone walking after midnight is immediately suspect by the police. All that racket, if you hear it in the background, is Michael and the tree trying to shift me about her, not about me. I had the scene with him at an interesting moment at the end of the scene where he confronts some bad guys with that demand that seems totally absurd. So I had that one scene, and then it's about getting that character. So he really wanted to know, who is this guy? Where does he get his confidence or this attitude? And what is he up to? And then things start to unfold almost automatically. That you just have to run to keep up with them sometimes.
Well, I know in other interviews, you've talked about your writing process, and you mentioned in one interview that you might write and rewrite 4 to 5 pages in 1 week. And then if someone came back and asked you 2 weeks later that you have then written 25 to 30 pages the following week. In the weeks that you're writing the 4 to 5 pages, are you aware that you're not ready to move beyond that fifth page? Or are you thinking ahead about the plot or characters?
You're always thinking ahead, sometimes both consciously and unconsciously. I'm surprised a lot of times when I think I have a problem with a character or a situation, and I move ahead a few pages and suddenly it was no problem at all and I understood the solution to it on an unconscious level. But I'm always sort of thinking ahead. I tend to do one page at a time and polish that page over and over until I feel comfortable about moving on. So I'm spending a lot of time, psychological time, with the characters and getting to know them so that when I write slowly like that at the beginning, for maybe a half book and relatively slow in the process, then I'm also getting to know the character. And because I believe character is more important than plot, it is in a book, though plot is quite important, the characters developing and becoming intriguing, interesting, and compelling, that's the essence of it. When I have that, they carry the story. And if I don't have that, that's when I get to that rare occasion when I think I've got to put this aside and think about these people and this situation better. And sometimes it resolves, sometimes it doesn't, but nearly always it does resolve. You know, give some time to become fully fleshed and open your mind.
Well, what was the process for you over the years of figuring out your kind of own creative and writing process? How did that work for you?
I spent a lot of years doing it all wrong, and that was in some ways very helpful. I started out writing paperback originals in the science fiction field. It was what I had read as a kid and a young adult, almost exclusively, so it's what I wanted to write. And I wrote it for a few years, and reasonably successfully, until one day I said, this isn't what I had any skill at doing properly. I sort of writing has been stuff, secondary kind of fiction to somebody else's bright ideas. And I don't like this. I will write something fresh and interesting, and it's more me. And that's when I gave that up, moved into a comic novel, first of all, and then into suspense, and then into multi-genres in the same book. And it was a slow learning process. And I don't know why it took me so long, but when I look back on it, I sold my first novel 15 or 16 years before I finally began to write the kind of novels that opened up to a unique audience of my own. And it was just, for me, a very slow learning process. And then when that damn thing, when there was a moment that I understood how I could do what I wanted to do, then it unfolded pretty rapidly over the next several books. I wish I had learned quicker, but that was the only way to do it. The problem for young writers these days is I don't think you have that 15 years to learn what you're doing that I had when publishing was a different universe than it is now, when you could write paperback originals and nobody held it against you if the sales were not what they ought to have been. These days, if you don't have sales they want to see, 4 or 5 books they almost write you off, Greg.
Well, during that 16-year period, were you trying on different styles and learning from every book?
Yes, in a stumbling sort of fashion. It looks to people from the outside as if I had this smooth ascending climb, and I may have always known what I was doing, but that in fact is not the case. But yes, it was learning along the way, getting better at it, and that means use of language, making the story unfold, developing character, and all of those things. But also at coming to understand, having what Japanese would call a satori, a moment of enlightenment, that you say, aha, and you suddenly begin to understand what it is that makes a story stand above others and how to proceed in a fashion that makes that certain to happen, or at least as certain as you can ever be to make it happen. And I don't know why that moment happens, why it took 15 or 16 years to me, why some people get it in 1 year or less. Some people get it on the first book they ever write. Some people get it on the first book they ever write and never recapture it again. So I count myself lucky that when I did suddenly understand what it took to make a book appeal to a wider audience, but not diminish in any way by the internet. Broad audience that actually made it richer. Then I was able to kind of keep doing it. And it was what excited me about writing. So I count myself fortunate. I'm not stupid enough to think I'm a genius. They figured it out and never lost it. I still fully understand it, but I know how to repeat it. Not that I repeat the story, but I know how to reach for that thing about characters and storylines. Makes people want to come back for the experience again.
Well, I know that previously you've written two how to write fiction books. Have you considered writing another one at this stage in your career?
Well, what I say to anyone who got those two books, throw them away, burn them, just some very final manner, because I thought I knew what I was doing when I wrote them. And it was only after those books I really started to learn. I thought of writing a book about writing. It would be very different now. My wife wants me to write a book about all the way things were screwed up throughout my career, because that happened a lot. I think there's value in that, along with maybe some thoughts about writing a different kind of instructive book that talks about what can go wrong inside your career, having to do with business, having to do with the people you work with who don't get what you're doing or trying to do. There's so many interesting things that happen in the writing career that either advance it or hold it back, and that actually had nothing to do with the quality of the writing. And I think it'd be very intriguing to just be very frank about those things in a book.
Well, on that note, obviously the publishing industry and just bookstores and reading in general is a lot different in 2023 than when you sold your first short stories or novels. What writing advice would you offer now for someone who may be working on their first stories or novels?
Well, I think that the way you tell a story and give it appeal either to niche audience or to Berlin, that pretty much hasn't changed, and that's still a mystery. One thing that has changed, I think, not for the better, is publishers all scramble these days to publish books that might be chosen by a book club. And that has really boiled down to meaning a book club operated by a celebrity or by a TV channel, network, somebody that can give a book a big push right at the beginning. And so that boils down to only a couple of kinds of books. And you're seeing a lot of certain types of books published over and over, a surfeit of them. And I don't think that's good for publishing, but everybody's chasing that one big thing. And the actual other big things that will come along will not be anything anybody's published before. So I used to say to young writers, when vampire novels were the biggest thing ever, don't write a vampire novel unless that's all you want to read and write. Because by the time you write a couple of vampire novels, nobody will want to read them anymore. And secondly, you will then be tagged as a vampire novelist, and nobody will want to buy anything else from you. So all of that is sort of the same. But what has changed is ways you get into the marketplace. Mass market paperback has largely been destroyed intentionally by the industry because the price point was too low, and they felt there was too little profit. In spite of the fact that it costs about 30 cents to public a mass market paperback, and they sell it for $10 and give a like 50% discount to store. I think they shot themselves in the foot when they did away with the mass market. So now you have hardcovers, trade paperbacks, and ebooks. And none of them have, not even together, made up for the lost ground in the paperback market, the mass market. So it's harder for writers these days to break through because they don't have that proving ground that used to be so common. So it takes more thought, more care, and having been a writer myself, I know that it is in our nature, most of us, not to think about it that much, to just get caught up in the excitement of the creation and plunge forward. But the way it is these days, I think you have to get more thought about what you're writing, how you're writing it, and how you expect it to be marketed by a publisher. And those are the things I can tap into in the book. But we would need 3 or 4 days to go through some of the parts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Well, are you working on a new novel now?
Well, yes, I've got 2 delivered that are pending publication after death. I'm hoping after death isn't predicting something in my own life, but I hope I'm alive the day after death is published. Then I've got a book called The Bad Weather Friend, which is a Spitz novel, but also a comic novel. And following that is a novel called The Huntress, which is pretty intense. And I'm working now on a book called Going Home in the Dark, which is also another comic novel, but somewhat different. My comic novels, like Life Expectancy, One Door Away from Heaven, are also heavy suspense novels. It's 2 things I find very interesting to mix together.
Well, how are you enjoying your publishing relationship with Amazon? From the outside, it seems that your creativity is not slowing down at all, and you're publishing 2 novels a year. How are you liking things with Amazon?
You know, it was an interesting leap to make. I go to Thomas & Mercer, which is an Amazon company. First of all, there's such a prejudice in the business against Amazon that not a lot of stores weren't carrying Thomas & Mercer books. But I had to look at what was happening in terms of support. My former publisher, Random House, what that business wanted to do with writers and what the opportunities were that were offered. And it wasn't what it used to be. And I felt I was struggling against prejudices in publishing and changes that were negative to my career. And I had to do something about it. It wasn't my intention to go to Amazon. It was my agent saying, we want to put into the mix the people making offers, all the regular big publishers, but also this imprint of Amazon. And I thought that was a very strange thing. But then when we got 8 or 9 offers, I can't remember now exactly, they were nearly all in the same kind of ballpark. But what was unusual was all the new publishers either gave me 1 or 2 page marketing plan or no marketing plan at all. While Amazon, Thomas and Mercer gave me a 40-page marketing plan. And I compared these things and thought, okay, everything was changing. And it may be that going with this Amazon company, you won't be on the bestseller list because they don't have these sales. And you won't be readily available in all bookstores, and there are bookstores. I still handle these books because I sign copies for them and I know them. And they're faithful to what I've done in the past. But there are other avenues through which you sell books these days. And those avenues are becoming greater and greater. So it was an odd decision, but it's been absolutely the right one for me because I'm working with a younger and more enthusiastic and interesting group, fairly creative, in a way you don't see that often in New York publishing, and very enthusiastic. They're designing covers. One thing they're doing is producing books. They're produced at a much higher level. They have very strong bindings instead of ones that we tend to see these things that fall apart when we read them. They do decorative boards. They do decorative end papers. The books look very nice. And that is something that used to be done in general publishing, but almost not anymore. If they can save the nickel here and 6 cents there, general publishers save it. But Thomas and Mercer, my books, is doing such a pretty job with the books. Being a book collector myself, I just like having these volumes. So it's worked out very well. I like everybody I'm working with. We're all on the same page. At least we have been through the books so far. And I think it's the best thing I could have done.
Well, I know at the beginning of your career, when you were talking about this 15 or 16 year period, when you were kind of developing your unique style and take on suspense and multi-genre, that you have mentioned that you were reading voraciously, sometimes 100 or 200 novels a year. Obviously, some of those were smaller paperbacks, as you mentioned. Are you still reading at the pace that you once were?
Not quite. Like I used to, partly that's because I really read a great deal more research material for the kind of books I've been writing. Seems like 3 years. And that takes a chunk of my reading time. But I still, if some new writer comes along, I hear about it, I want to know what's going on with that. And I also like to go back and reread books that I admired 40, 50 years ago, and I feel formed my own style or helped form it, and see what I think of them now. Was I an idiot at that time? Did I really have some good sense of the time of what I was reading? So I recently have been back rereading John D. MacDonald novels, and lo and behold, they hold up just as well as ever, maybe a little better than I. So that's occupied my time reading
a lot lately. Well, to paraphrase Ray Bradbury, he said something along the lines of, you can live forever with your creative output, whether it's stories or novels or films. What is your thought about that?
Well, I'd just rather live forever for real. But if it had through the literate output, so be it. Nobody knows in that regard whether what you work on will be read 50 or 100 years from now. I've been fortunate books I wrote 4 years ago have stayed in print all that time and never lapsed. So in that regard, I've been lucky. You like to think that there will be certain things you've written that will continue to go on for a long time after it passed. But there's no guarantee, just as there's no guarantee, the world itself will be here long after you pass. So I tend to write, and always have, most of all, for my own pleasure. It's always a story I wish somebody would have written that I could read. And if when I'm writing, I'm laughing out loud at something funny that happens, or I get that chill on something pretty desperate as underlay for the character, then I know it's working. And what I'm actually writing is a book for me. And I think in the end, that's what means you're writing something that is going to touch other people at a deeper level, because you're at the same time you're writing for yourself, you're putting all of yourself into it that you can. And in the end, it's the voice of the author, the uniqueness about the approach to storytelling that makes something worth reading and worth lasting.
That's wonderful. Well, again, we've been speaking to best-selling writer Dean Koontz. His new novel, After Death, will be published on July 18th, and you can pre-order the novel now. And Dean, thanks for doing this interview.
Well, thanks for having me there and putting up with my voice and me. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Brilliance Audio.
After Death by Dean Koontz. Performed by Eduardo Ballerini. Even at this hour, when real-world devils have just recently gone to sleep, and only honest working folks are preparing for the blessing of labor, Michael can't curb Carter Woodbine's Bentley in front of Nina Dozier's house. To do so will make her a subject of even greater interest to the gangbangers who currently harass her. He parks the sedan in the lot of a dentist's office, where the greater disorder of her neighborhood meets the lesser disorder of another community. En route, he'd stopped to take $100,000 from the $500,000 and had secreted those 10 packets in the spare tire well of the car's trunk. Now he slips the strap of the duffel over his right shoulder, his hand within the open top of the bag, holding Santana's pistol in a relaxed grip, and he sets out to walk 8 blocks. Although this is a crime-racked area, he doesn't think trouble is inevitable or even likely. For all its dangers, this is not an outpost of hell. Nevertheless, there is no safe neighborhood these days, and any homeboy with an active imagination might be as interested in a duffel bag as in the flash of a solid gold Rolex. This is a residential district, where precious illumination is allowed in a time of shortages. However, the lampposts are old and insufficiently bright, and the milky globes atop a number of them have been shot out or broken with stones. The street trees are nearly as old as the city and have not been properly maintained in decades. Through the intricate thatchery of branches, the veiled glow of the westering moon is reduced to a stippling of gray light on the otherwise dark sidewalk. When any vehicle approaching from behind him slows down, he tenses in expectation that it will stop, that a confrontation might occur. They all motor eastward, toward a thin, ashen radiance along the eastern rim of the world that is rising as though the lost continent of Atlantis is slowly surfacing in the sea of night. The houses are mostly bungalows, stucco or clapboard, on small lots. Some are maintained with pride. An equal number are crumbling toward condemnation, the lawns long neglected. Perhaps 10% are abandoned. This is Vig territory, a gang as dangerous as the Bloods of the Crips, their name shortened from vigorous, to imply that they have drive, force, and strength. Nina Dozier's stucco bungalow is in good repair, colorless in these last minutes of darkness, but in daylight, pale blue with white trim. 2 small bedrooms, 1 bath, a living room that also serves as a home office, an eat-in kitchen, maybe 700 square feet in all. The house had belonged to her mom and dad. She inherited it, along with a mortgage, when they were run down and killed in a crosswalk as they were coming home from a local market with bags of groceries. The hit-and-run driver, later caught, was a methamphetamine freak with a long rap sheet, recently released on bail after being charged with carjacking. He was driving a stolen Lincoln Aviator that he totaled later that day, without injury to himself. Because Nina's son will be sleeping at this hour, Michael goes around the bungalow to the back, as they arranged. She is sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee, slim and fresh-faced, one of those women who seems too small to withstand the storms of this world, but walks through them all unbent, a mahogany Madonna. He taps softly on one of the four panes in the top half of the door, and she looks up. In spite of the proofs that he provided to her, she is clearly astonished that he has shown up as promised. Her surprise isn't accompanied with relief. She is accustomed to people and fate disappointing her just when her expectations are highest. She disengages the two deadbolts and opens the door. Michael steps into this humble home, in which lives the hope of the world.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.